The Aldershot Affair. Clarence Herbert knew. At 3 in the afternoon, a smart landaulet upholstered in Venetian red suede rolled noiselessly up to the ladies' entrance of the Carlton Hotel. From his glass-enclosed sentry box, the doorman telephoned the reception office that the Condessa de la Montaneta's car was at the door, and one of the clerks repeated the information over the wire to Madame's suite on the third floor, where her two Moorish maids were assisting her into a hat and wrap just over from Paris, the envy of every woman who saw them. When she had descended in the lift, her footman, who, with the chauffeur, had also the appearance of being a Moor, assisted her into the landaulet. As the Condessa's comings and goings were of interest to everyone in the hotel on account of her undeniable beauty, taste in clothes, wealth, and social prominence, it was quite in the natural order of things for the page and chambermaids in charge of the third floor to be standing at the end of the corridor, watching her as she came along to the lift. It was also a matter of daily occurrence for one of the maids to enter the room presently with an armful of clean towels and, attaching the hose to a baseboard plug, groom the carpets and furniture with a vacuum cleaner during Madame's absence. The two Moorish girls occupied a small room at the end of the suite and were usually more or less in evidence when any of the hotel employees came in, not that they appeared suspicious, but they were seldom out of sight long enough for outsiders to do any prying whatsoever. This time, however, the chambermaid heard them talking in one of the farther rooms as if they hadn't noticed her coming in, and she made the most of a long-awaited opportunity. Leaning the nozzle of her cleaner against the door casing, she went noiselessly over to the davenport, where the Condessa's correspondence by the morning's post lay neatly piled. It seemed to be, however, the pigeonholes which particularly interested the girl. With practiced rapidity, she ran through a number of papers and letters, opened the secret drawer which everyone knows how to open in the usual desk of this sort, and then began going systematically through the pile of correspondence. After 15 minutes or so, she became conscious of a pricking sensation through the left side of her corset. Turning, with a chill of apprehension, she saw a pair of gleaming black eyes over her left shoulder. The point of a slender Moorish knife with a razor-like edge was pressing gently yet painfully into her flesh, and she realized that one quick shove from the sinewy arm would send it through her heart.
"Thou hast a desire to read what is written to the great and beautiful one? Aye, thou shalt tell her of thy desire when she returns. Until then shalt thou sit in that corner with folded arms, and one will sit by thee with this knife against thy side."
Perforce, the girl made the best of it. To her amazement, Madame la Condessa paid no attention to the tableau in the corner when she finally returned. The other maid removed her hat and wrap, followed her into the dressing room, where she took off Madame's afternoon costume and replaced it with a negligee. Then the Condessa walked leisurely out and sat down before the davenport. She spoke beautiful English, with here and there a pretty Spanish accent.
"Ah, you found her going through my papers, Aisha. I see. I wonder what you discovered of interest among them, miss. Let me see. You are the maid on this floor, I believe, and your name is Betty, the short for Elizabeth, of course, or should I say Bettina, eh?"
To her utter amazement, the girl noticed a peculiar position of Madame's hand as she lightly touched a wisp of hair just above her ear. Half incredulously, the chambermaid closed her eyes for a second and let her teeth rest upon her lower lip. It was a natural facial expression of weariness or pain, and would have attracted no attention from anyone not particularly observant, but it was promptly answered by another imperceptible signal from Madame, who began to smile at the maid's confusion and amazement.
"If you could have assisted me, I should have made use of you before this, Betty. The Heir Chudley Sammis, who is Member of Parliament, told me there were two of you, and a man in this hotel. But it is dangerous that more than a few of us should know one another. There are too many of the Downing Street people to watch each one and note with whom they appear to have a secret understanding. As to my papers here, I am quite sure you found nothing to interest you. We of Wilhelmstrasse are not careless, as you know. But you will forget everything you have seen in this room, everything which concerns me in any way. You recognize this ring, do you not?"
She held out her left hand, upon one finger of which was a beautiful table-cut emerald, which the maid knew at a glance was worn only by those high in authority among the Wilhelmstrasse secret agents.
"Very good. You will make no mistake in regard to me. If I find myself in danger and can make use of you, I will give the emergency signal. If I need your assistance with a secret communication, I will ring the bell of my suite 3 times. So, meanwhile, you will hint to your 2 companions in the hotel that I am not to be interfered with or spied upon in any way. A hint should be enough, without giving them further information concerning me. If they do not take that hint, they are likely to hear from Berlin, unpleasantly. Now, you may go."
The girl knew that several women of the nobility were among the higher inner circle of the German Secret Service, and had no doubts whatever that the Condessa was one of them. Dropping upon one knee, she kissed the hand extended to her, murmuring profuse apologies for her mistake, and then hurriedly left the suite. A few moments later, Madame was about to dress for dinner when there was a knock at the outer door of the suite, and Ayesha admitted Lady Blanche Parker, who, with Colonel Sir Thomas Parker, KCB, was occupying a suite upon the same floor of the hotel while her townhouse was being redecorated. She had been among the first to whom the Condessa had taken a personal fancy after her arrival in London, and a somewhat intimate friendship had sprung up between them. Just now she appeared nervous, ill at ease.
"You were about to dress for dinner, Condessa. Don't let me delay you. May I come in and chat while you change?"
"I've really nothing on hand for the evening before 11, my dear, and one should not talk confidentially before one's mates, don't you know? You see, I have adopted the English idiom, see? Let us remain here where there is nobody to overhear. I think you are not quite yourself. No, tell me."
"Oh, it's quite stupid of me to care. Men do such things. I suppose they don't really mean anything by it half the time. Before this horrible war started, I thought I was the happiest woman in England. I loved my husband so much that I was foolish over him. I really did. And I hadn't the least doubt in the world that he returned it. We'd lived within a few miles of each other in Hants ever since we were born. I used to be crazy over the way he sat a horse when he rode to hounds, practiced day after day, so I could keep up with him and take the same jumps that he did. Then we settled down in Feathercote together, living a perfectly ideal life. Finally the war came, and I'd the awful dread that Tom would be among the first killed. I knew, of course, that his regiment would be sent at once, because they were veteran troops. He was slightly wounded near Lille and sent home. After he recovered, his capacity for organization got him a billet at one of the training camps. Then he was transferred to Aldershot because it was his home neighborhood, and he knew practically everybody within a radius of 20 miles. He's been most successful in the recruiting, you know. Well, of course, his duties gave him little time for me, but his business with the War Office made it advisable to spend at least half his nights in town, and I thought I should see a lot more of him up here."
"And don't you? I see you with El Signor Coronel in the big dining room almost every evening."
"Yes, but his manner has been very much changed during the last few weeks. He is more preoccupied, gives me less of the old perfect companionship. Today I found out why. I came into the suite rather quietly and walked through to the room where he does his writing. He was sitting at his desk, as I expected, but one of the hotel maids was standing by his side, leaning on his shoulder. His arm was around her and he was, well, hugging her. She seemed to be enjoying it, the hussy."
"Oh, as you say, my dear, men do those things without thinking twice about them. They consider it mere passing amusement. You may be sure you have nothing serious to fear from a hotel servant. It would be quite too ridiculous. In the lifetime of my husband, El Conde de la Montaneta, he had that weakness, like other men. But I was La Doña Condesa. I never did notice such little occurrences when he was indiscreet. There was one, a mantilla maker of Seville, who danced most divinely. El Conde would take her for a ride in the country in his grand motor car. The poor thing needed fresh air. But I could discover no difference in his respect and affection for me. No, never. Which of the maids did El Señor Coronel honor with his embrace?
Well, I suppose some people might call her quite good-looking, in a bold, provocative way. It was that Betty woman.
So, El Coronel showed most perfect taste when he married you, my dear. And he compliments you by selecting a different but most handsome type for his passing amour. The little Betty, she is really beautiful, I think, if one dressed her au grande dame. She is plump, full of fire. What man with blood in his veins could help the little embrace? Perhaps a kiss or two from a ripe little baggage like that, if there was opportunity and she was not unwilling. Eh, my dear? Poof! It is nothing. A moment's relaxation to lighten the anxieties of his professional work. Come, I will propose you a diversion. You trust me, do you not? You do not think I would deliberately rob you of your husband's love?
You rob me, Condessa? I don't understand.
I will be more plain. I wish to show the young wife that passing flirtation is merely a game with most men, that it has nothing to do with the love they have for their wives. It is merely the excitement of the chase, the capture, the collecting tribute. Look you, my dear, you shall throw me in the society of El Señor Coronel, arrange that we shall be tête-à-tête, with no one to observe and listen. Me, I am handsome woman, no? I shall make your husband flirt with me, and forget the little Betty entirely. When I get him very much work up, I shall make him laugh with me at the game we both play. I shall kiss him goodbye and say the joke must not go further any more because you are my dear friend and would be annoyed if you should discover us when we were careless. Then will he be punished for the little Betty with her neat ankles and pretty figure. He will remember that yours are much prettier and belong to him. You see?
Yes, I see. But suppose you should fall in love with Tom yourself. I'd be afraid of you, Condessa.
I will make El Coronel Tom think I loved him, my dear, and you also would think so until we have the final laugh. But for me, there is one man in all the world. He is married, man. I shall never have him. Even if his wife die, he might never marry me. But once, he saved my life and nearly lost his own. From then I am loving him more than everything in the world. With other men I flirt to pass the time. See, why not? But none of them shall have me, except that one. When Andalusians really love, it is forever.
Lady Parker's eyes were star-like with admiration.
Oh, that is something perfectly ideal, Condessa. I could love Tom like that if I thought he cared for me the same way. I suppose I mustn't try to guess who it is.
It is better not, my dear. If you desire, I shall flirt with your husband and distract his mind. But I will not love him. I promise you that. You shall stand behind the scenes and see the game. When you tire of it, I will stop playing.
About 1 o'clock in the morning, a clerk in the hotel office, very well liked by the guests on account of his pleasant manner and ability for straightening out their various grievances, went quietly from his room in the employees' quarters up to the roof over the Haymarket side. As one of those who conducted the business of the hotel, his presence in any part of it, at any hour, would have been accepted as being in the line of his duties. So also, to a lesser extent, the third-floor chambermaid Betty, who appeared upon the roof a few moments later, gazing into the murky atmosphere overhead in a terrified search for bomb-dropping zeppelins. The few detached areas of flat roof above the curved and sloping mansards had been protected in a way that made demolition of the building unlikely. Their surface had been covered to a depth of 3 feet with bags of sand, and above the mansards which sloped toward the inner courts had been stretched a canopy of steel wire netting. After the one rather disastrous raid of German dirigibles, 2 watchmen had been stationed on the roofs each night to warn guests upon the upper floors in case of another, but their services had been discontinued after a while because of their doubtful utility in such an emergency. So that, excepting some of the help whose fears or curiosity impelled them to go up at night for a look around, the roofs were deserted. As Betty stopped cautiously over the sandbags toward one of the farther chimneys, she stopped to gaze upward as if looking for a dirigible. Her actions were so entirely natural that, had anyone been watching her, it is doubtful if he would have been suspicious. Eventually, she stepped around behind a massive chimney, where Mr. James Crofton, the office clerk, was imperturbably smoking an excellent cigar. As he noticed the direction from which she had approached, he started apprehensively.
"Got, Bettina! You came over the middle of those bags, yes?"
"Why, of course I did. Suppose anyone had been watching. It would never do to give an impression of skulking about up here."
"So? Better that risk than get blown to the devil before you have accomplished your work. Look you, Bettina, at every yard distance all over this roof is a bag of sand in which there are one or more sticks of dynamite. Your weight upon the loosely packed sand is sufficient to explode a stick if it happened to come just right. If one explodes, they'll all go off. When just one little bomb from a Zeppelin happens to drop on this roof, it must surely set off all the dynamite. There's enough of it up here to destroy every building within 100 yards. I've planted those sticks one at a time, and if we hear an explosion in another part of the city, we must get out of this hotel as quickly as we can dress."
"Ach Gott, Johann, this is terrible. It is not as if we were killing the English soldiers. If your dynamite goes off, it will kill all these pretty little children in the hotel, the young girls, just coming to their marrying time. They have done Germany no harm."
"Woman, such talk is foolishness. Those kinder will grow up to be Englander men and women, mothers of Englander soldiers. They must be taught to fear Germany. That fear must be foremost in the mothers' minds, so the children will be marked with it. They must know it is not safe to defy the Kaiser, as they have done."
"But look you, Johann, these English only swear to fight us the more when we do such things. There has been no trouble in recruiting since the Zeppelins came. I have been here much longer than you, and our campaigns of frightfulness have had just the opposite effect from what we expected."
"Ach, you are a woman. You cannot understand these things like the officers of our general staff. But enough. Tell me what you have discovered among the papers of the Condessa."
"Suppose you tell me, Johann, why you thought there would be anything of interest to us among them."
"I am told by Karl Berndorf that the Condessa's family were practically unknown before she married the Conde de la Montaneta 6 years ago, which is suspicious. Spanish grandees do not marry that sort of women, except morganatically. She has with her 4 servants who are supposed to be Moors. They talk with each other in Arabic, very true, but in much too pure Arabic for the Moors of Tangier or Cadiz, where Madame came from. Since her arrival in London, she has become quite intimate with some of the most prominent men and women in the country. She could scarcely have brought letters that would have secured such an entree for her in a space of 7 or 8 weeks. She spends money as if her wealth were almost unlimited. Yet Berndorf was quite positive that the old Conde's estates in Andalusia had become very much curtailed before his death. I don't know exactly what to make of her myself. Her Castilian is so perfect that she must be Spanish, and yet..."
"She is probably of the Austrian court circle, my friend, with her family dating back to Charles V or earlier, which accounts for her Spanish blood and home. And she is of Wilhelmstrasse, like ourselves, only far higher in authority. By the ring she wears, I think she must be one of the Imperial special agents. One of her Moorish maids caught me going through the papers in her desk and held a knife against my ribs for 3 long hours, until Madame returned. I thought I must be drugged or dreaming when she casually gave me the first recognition sign. It made me feel like a fool. Getting caught at her papers like a clumsy sneak thief, when some of those cabinet men are probably dropping government secrets to her, which neither you nor I could get if our lives depended on it. Oh, they wouldn't know they were telling her anything dangerous for England. Trust her for that. But the woman is a hypnotist and a mind reader. She said that the heir Chudley Sammis had told her there were 3 of us in this hotel, and I'm beginning to think she must have been working with him in influencing the cabinet ministers."
"Himmel! And I never even dreamt. It explains those Moorish servants, too. They must be high-caste Hindu revolutionists, the sort who will stop at nothing so long as they smash the English Raj. Valuable tools if one knows how to handle them. Look you, Bettina, the Condesa has become most intimate with Lady Parker, and Air Colonel is fascinated with her. I saw him looking at her as she talked with her ladyship in the foyer last night. Why wouldn't she have a better chance than you to obtain the plans from him?
She might, if he were anywhere near her own rank. But women of her position do not go as far as those in our station of life to obtain what Wilhelm Strasser requires. They will risk and sacrifice life, yes, if necessary, but giving themselves is something they are not likely to do. I'll admit that they're often successful without.
Would you pay the price, if necessary, Bettina?
That's something you'll never know. It's none of your business. I think I can make the Colonel tell me anything I want to know when the conditions are just right. But if I can't, I'll ask Madame's assistance. You need have no doubts upon that score. Katrina heard her ladyship accepting an invitation for charity bridge tomorrow afternoon, when the Colonel is likely to be at Aldershot, and she asked me if I would come to their suite about 3 with the vacuum cleaner. He's quite sure to be there.
On the following day, Lady Parker motored away from the hotel at 2:30, Sir Thomas being presumably at Aldershot. It occurred to her that he might run up to the city earlier than usual and amuse himself with the pretty chambermaid, if she happened to be on duty at that hour. But the Condessa had talked to such good purpose that she believed it merely a passing foolishness upon her husband's part, which she would better ignore, and she was dwelling with mischievous anticipation upon his punishment for it when the Condessa herself should take a hand. So she was in no hurry to return before it was time to dress for dinner. At 3:00, Betty, in her dainty apron and short black skirt, came to Sir Thomas's door with the reel of vacuum hose and long nozzle, letting herself in with a passkey but taking care to bolt the door on the inside. As on a previous occasion, the Colonel was at his desk in the sitting room. While pointing out what he wished done, he managed to get a half-reluctant kiss or two that made him hungry for more. Presently, he told her to let the cleaning go for a while, and drew her down upon the sofa by his side.
"Betty, you use a devilish sight better language than any hotel chambermaid I ever saw. I'd be quite interested, don't you know, if you'd tell me all about yourself and how you happen to be in such a position as this. Might be able to help you on a bit, do you see? One never can say. I fancy your family are a cut above the ordinary lot. What?"
"Oh, my people were really very decent, sir. My father was a younger son of Major Bundy, who served in the Crimea, one of the Dorset Bundys, you know. There wasn't money enough to purchase a commission for him after his eldest brother went into the Guards, so he took orders and was appointed curate of a small parish on the Shaftesbury estates. He was made rector when we girls were in our teens, but died a year afterward, and of course left us practically nothing. The living was a small one. My mother died several years before, and my sister married a small tradesman in Southampton. So there was nothing left for me to do but go out in service. We'd been decently educated, of course. I could have obtained a position as governess, but the wages are not so high as I get here, and I have a few hours to myself every day. These grand hotels require maids who have some education, enough taste to assist the guests with their clothes, if necessary, and present an attractive appearance. When my father was living, my social position was good enough to permit of my calling upon any family in the county. While now, I'm a servant, and must know my place. But I'm much more independent here, and am putting by a good bit of money each month. In a few years I shall go to America, and open a little millinery shop. Over there I'm as good as anybody."
"Faith, and so you are in London, if people only knew it. I suppose you make a bit in tips as well?"
"Perhaps more than you'd think, Sir Thomas. To a girl who has scrimped and denied herself even necessities while trying to be a lady on nothing a year, it's quite too ridiculous to have a fat dowager give 1/2 a sovereign merely for selecting her most becoming gown and turning her out at her very best for some dinner party. And the men! Why, I've had an old duke give me 3 sovereigns for promising to forget all about it after I'd slapped his face for trying to kiss me.
Hey, what's that? Do you mean to say it's an ordinary occurrence for men to, take advantage of your position and, kiss you? My word.
No, there's a difference between kissing one and, well, trying to do it.
But what? Eh? Dash it all. You know, I've... Eh? And I believe I've never tipped you a penny as yet. Leave all that sort of thing to her ladyship, don't you know? Of course, if I'd known about your family, inexcusable liberty, you know. Quite welcome to slap me if you wish, and,
I trust, Sir Thomas, that you've too much taste and good sense to offer me money, now that you know something of my private affairs. I permitted you to do what you did because you have always treated me kindly, never taken a low advantage of me. But there's no great harm in your kissing me, I fancy. But if you were seen doing it, I should probably lose my position here. I should have to complain of you to the management. Rather than have any trouble with a wealthy guest, they'd give me the sack.
Faith, you need have no fears upon that score. If they discharged you, I'd find something better at once, or see that you had a good start in some other place. I say, Betty, do you know, I think an awful lot of you. 'Pon honour I do, I say. Would it be possible for me to see you outside anywhere? When do you, get out of the hotel? Where do you go?
I have 3 evenings off each week. Sometimes I go to a cinema show with 2 of the other maids. Occasionally Mr. Crofton takes me out to a burlesque or to one of the Strand restaurants for dinner. Or we go to a dance hall where he teaches me the latest steps.
Crofton? You mean the clerk in the hotel office? A decent young fellow, that. You're not engaged to him, what?
No fear. Why did you wish to know that?
Well, do you see, after all, you know, Crofton's merely a middle-class chap. Not your sort, really. And, I'd jolly well like to have you go about with me, if we can manage it. And,
You couldn't take me to the theatre, Sir Thomas, or any public place where her ladyship might see us. Of course, when I am dressed for the street or for an evening out, I fancy no one in the hotel would recognise me. But still, her ladyship must be very well known in London society.
Quite so, my dear. But I've cousins and other women relatives, do you see, whom I frequently show the sights when they're up for the day or so. If her ladyship happens to run across us, most unlikely, don't you know, I can introduce you as one of, one of a brother officer's family, do you see. Up from the Aldershot for the evening. Eh? Meet me tomorrow evening in the lounge at the Cecil, and we'll go somewhere for dinner, make a night of it. Eh? Will you? Well, that's jolly. Now, eh? Just one more kiss to seal the bargain.
For a second or two her lips clung to his with a warmth that made him dizzy. Then she was gone. He sat down at his desk and foolishly tried to fix his attention upon the papers he had been examining. 2 weeks later, she accompanied him to his townhouse in order that he might show her some books and pictures which he had recently purchased. The decorators had finished their work. His butler had been up from Hampshire superintending the cleaning for a day or two, and had finally returned, leaving the house ready for occupancy at any time he should be ordered to bring up the requisite staff of servants. A watchman inspected the premises, outside at intervals, but the colonel had told him that he should be working late that night with his private secretary. They had the house to themselves. She had met him that evening in a chiffon gown of dark green which amazed him by its perfect taste and the way it set off her blonde prettiness. How she had managed to dress in such a garment in the servants' quarters of a hotel he couldn't understand. She had really gone, with her maid's uniform covered by a mackintosh, to the house of a very respectable widow in Soho, a place which had been a secret rendezvous of German spies since the 3rd month of the war, and changed there. They had dined at a quiet but famous restaurant just off Pall Mall, and the colonel had taken rather more than his usual allowance of champagne. When he produced 2 cobwebby bottles of Burgundy from his own cellar, she made no remonstrance, but had he noticed it, there was a calculating look in her eyes. She had learned before this about how much stimulation was needed to loosen his tongue, but the exact point at which mind and memory became oblivious to what he did was still a little uncertain. How far to let him go in his drinking, where to stop him before he became drowsily speechless, was a matter of nice calculation. Early that afternoon, the Condessa had motored to the Trevor mansion in Park Lane. Had any of her acquaintances been in the drawing room when she was admitted, presumably to call upon Lady Trevor, they would have been much astonished by the liberties she took. Running upstairs to her ladyship's boudoir, she closed the door and called upon the Foreign Office, asking the operator to put her on to the private office of Sir Edward Ray, Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. In a moment, his voice came over the wire, saying that he would motor out to Park Lane at once. She received him in the big library on the ground floor 15 minutes later.
"What mare's nest have you been stirring up, Nan?"
"You've been looking up Colonel Sir Thomas Parker, as I asked."
"Aye, but there's nothing fishy that we can discover, except his weakness for women, and that's hereditary, you know."
"I had supposed it must be,"
dryly.
"Tell me all you know about the man, Ned. I've heard of his courtship and marriage, in fact, pretty much everything Lady Blanche could give me."
"Well, let me see. He was a son of General Sir Harrington Parker, who was on the staff of engineers in the 60s and had a good deal to do with the permanent improvements at Aldershot in 1890. It's within 10 miles of Feathercote, the Parker estate in Hampshire, you know. Sir Thomas was a lad of 18 at the time the reconstruction was started, and during his vacations he rode all over the place with his father. Had a taste for engineering even then, and was permitted to superintend bits of the minor construction work occasionally. I fancy he must have preserved every plan his father drew, because the War Office is finding his knowledge of Aldershot and other military camps valuable even now, and he frequently runs over to Feathercote for the purpose of consulting old drawings on file there."
"Do you know whether duplicates of those drawings were preserved in the War Office?"
"Never had occasion to look up anything of the sort, but unquestionably there must have been."
"Do you suppose Kitchener has men in his department who would be able to put their hands on those Aldershot drawings within half an hour or so?"
"I fancy there'll be no doubt of that. I'll have them put me on to him, and I'll ask to have the papers sent here at once, if you think they'll be of any use to us."
The telephoning was a matter of but a few moments, War Office calls having right of way.
"Well, go on with the Colonel's history. We've not finished with that yet. When a man of 43 has as young and pretty a wife as Lady Blanche, quite devoted to him, why does he kiss pretty chambermaids in a hotel if he's presumably sober?"
"Eh? My word, been up to that sort of thing, has he? Just casually, as anyone might, or is he taking her on for a continuous performance?"
"Well, I fancy he's had her out to dinner and the theatre more than once."
"Humph! Must be a cut above the ordinary hotel maid. Is she pretty? Good taste in clothes?"
"Quite. She's a Wilhelmstrasse woman, Ned. What I'm trying to get at is her chance of pumping him for anything he may know."
"Why, might be a bit serious if there were anything in his head that Wilhelmstrasse desired to know. For at least 5 or 6 generations the men of his family have been unable to resist a pretty woman. His great-grandfather jilted an English lady to run off with the princess of a small German state. Their marriage was never recognized, and he was killed in a duel with her cousin. His grandfather married a baroness, lovely woman, 4 beautiful children, and lived openly with a well-known prima donna in Paris. His father had various affairs in different parts of the world, wherever the War Office sent him on engineering work. They've all been quite open about it, don't you know? Never seem to realize that what they do is anything more than a peccadillo which anyone of taste should ignore. They've all been fond of their wives and family, too, but there's something in the blood which catches fire at the glimpse of a pretty face or ankle. The trait is not uncommon. There's many a prominent and respectable man in London who has it. The principal thing which interests me in this affair of Sir Thomas's is what the little baggage may get out of him, and from the information at our disposal I can think of practically nothing. The Colonel has no knowledge of where troops are going when they leave Aldershot. His work deals with barracks construction, seeing that the various units are quartered to advantage for prompt assembling and departure when the orders come, sanitary matters, that sort of thing. He's not in position to know anything about munition supply, new guns, new aeroplanes, or anything like that. Of course, he must have some knowledge that Germany would like to obtain, but it's second-hand when it comes to him. He's not the man from whom they'd attempt to get it. Ah, here comes Lieutenant Graham from the War Office, with a bundle of papers, the Aldershot drawings, no doubt. I say, Nan, you'd best disappear until I've sent him off again, don't you know? The Condessa della Montanetta isn't supposed to be interested in anything of this sort, and I fancy you've no intention of discarding your make-up at present.
When the lieutenant had delivered the Aldershot drawings to Sir Edward and had left the house, Lady Nan, still with the black hair, darker complexion, and fuller figure of the Condessa, returned to the library, and they sat down to a study of the various plans in detail. The earlier sketches appeared to have been submitted to the War Office for a reconstruction of Aldershot Camp prior to those adopted during the administration of Secretary Stanhope in 1890. These were followed by the tentative plans subsequently approved in part, including the replacing of the old wooden huts of the Crimean period by substantial brick and stone barracks. Considerable attention appeared to have been given the question of water supply. A number of drawings illustrating plans for bringing pure drinking water from streams or ponds at considerable distance. The system eventually carried out was found in its proper place and was shown as completed in a survey made of the district in 1898, evidently a tracing from General Parker's original. It was Lady Nan who presently discovered upon this old survey of the General's some dotted lines which represented a 4-foot main of cast-iron piping, not connected with the system which had been adopted, but leading off northwestward from a point near Fleet Pond, and terminating in the woods of Bramshill Common 8 miles away. An asterisk called her attention to a note upon the margin of the tracing, in writing so fine and faded with age that she used a magnifying glass to read it. Dotted lines represent section of 4-foot water main laid underground at time the work was abandoned. Part of Sir John Fulcombe's plan in 1884 for bringing water from River Kennet, 6 miles southwest of Reading, was to have been emergency supply, location of line known only to Engineer Corps, in whose charge pumping station was to have been maintained. Plan was approved by Her Majesty the Queen, but after 10 months' work it was decided by War Office that artesian wells could be sunk, if necessary, at far less expense. For several moments Lady Nan studied the dotted lines on the tracing, noting the location of turnpikes and other roads which crossed them between Aldershot and the spot where they terminated. Then she took from one of the library files a section of Bartholomew's half-inch to the mile topographic map covering Berkshire, with the borders of Hampshire and Surrey.
"Ned, this is what Wilhelmstrasse is after, the original of this tracing. They want to know the exact survey line of that old, long-forgotten water main. It must be there, just as it was laid down over 30 years ago, probably a good deal eaten with rust, and yet, with neither water nor fresh air in it for all that time, there wouldn't be so much oxidation after all. Now what possible use could any German spy in England make of that water main? The Aldershot end of it is at the extreme westerly edge of the camp. Even if they had men enough in Berkshire, they couldn't get them crawling through that pipe fast enough to surprise the troops now camped around Aldershot. We must have over 200,000 there at this moment. My word, that's a lot of men, isn't it, for one instruction camp? Do you suppose that's the idea working in the German mind? A force of nearly 250,000 picked troops bunched within a limited radius? Couldn't have anything to do with a Zeppelin attack, could it, Ned? I say, we're getting warm, don't you think? And we've spent all the time we need to on these drawings. The location of that old water main is undoubtedly what they're trying to get out of Sir Thomas, and that pretty little devil Betty will somehow manage it before she's through with him. Humph! I shall have to take a hand in this. There's not a moment to lose. Is Ahmed out there for my car? Let me lock this tracing in George's safety vault down underground, and you take the rest back to Kitchener with my best love and thanks for the loan of them. Oh, wait a moment. Perhaps I'd better keep one of those other drawings with this one. I think I can use it to advantage. Any one of the final plans will do.
The Condessa knew that Sir Thomas's duties would keep him at Aldershot most of the following afternoon. Starting at 2 o'clock, she motored the 33 miles in something over an hour, and was in the ladies' room at the officers' club with the wife of a well-known general when Sir Thomas came in for his tea before running up to town. As both were returning in time to dress for dinner at the Carlton, she invited him to accompany her, an opportunity which he accepted with every appearance of unexpected pleasure. The colonel admired his wife's distinguished friend extremely, but hadn't dared, for obvious reason, to make any advances in the way of flirtation. So when she started in with him on a basis of friendly intimacy, he began to imagine himself a devil of a fellow with the women. By the time they reached town, the flirtation had progressed far enough for her to agree that she would accompany him that evening to a rather exclusive cabaret in the West End, patronized by well-known musicians and writers. She was the woman of the world in every word and action, so brilliant in repartee that his duller wits found it difficult to keep pace with her. One of the handsomest women in London, alluring, provocative, and beginning to be a celebrity. He knew the moment they entered the cabaret that her presence with him added materially to his reputation. Under conditions of this sort, his infatuation was a foregone conclusion. Inside of a week, it had reached a point where he scarcely looked up from his papers when Betty came into his suite at the Carlton, which provoked and alarmed that intriguing young person. Before the Condessa took a hand in the game, she had obtained a part of what she hoped to get from him, but it wasn't enough for her purpose. Furthermore, she was in doubt as to where she stood with the Condessa, who certainly appeared to be interfering as far as Sir Thomas Parker was concerned. Bettina, however, gave no indication of having noticed this, until she went into the Condessa's suite one day and was invited to sit down for a chat after the Moorish maids had been sent from the room.
"Betty, you remember the day you were interested in my papers and spent a few uncomfortable hours being prodded by Aisha's knife?" "Oh yes, madam. I think your maid would have enjoyed killing me." "Had you made any resistance, she most certainly would have killed you. That girl is worth her weight in kronen to anyone in our position. Well, you learned something about me which surprised you, even as we were surprised to know that you were also a Wilhelmstrasse. Since then we have ignored your connection with Berlin, and of course you've paid no further attention to me in that respect. Still, one cannot help noticing such things are apparent for anyone to see. I was in the theatre box one evening when you sat in the stalls with Colonel Sir Thomas Parker. I could only guess at your object in cultivating him until he began paying me very marked attentions. Then I heard all about his father's connection to Aldershot and knew that you must be working upon the plan which was under consideration several months ago. My own work has been in a different quarter altogether. In fact, I know nothing of the details which have been worked out in your affair, but an opportunity presented itself unexpectedly to pick up something which I am quite sure you can use to advantage. I didn't dare keep it, so made a tracing upon strong parchment tissue at a certain house where I was sure of being undisturbed, and put the original back where I found it."
She drew from a drawer in her davenport a tracing of the old Fulcombe water system, just as it had been drawn by General Parker in 1884. Showing the dotted lines of the 4-foot main which had been partially laid down, then abandoned. Betty picked up a large reading glass and eagerly examined the drawing, going over it with an attention to detail which indicated considerable knowledge of engineering.
"It will be useful, madame, because the original, which we stole from a library drawer at Feathercote, Sir Thomas's place in Hampshire, was accidentally destroyed. A draught blew it into a sea-coal fire at our rendezvous in Soho. I was hoping, really hoping, that you had managed by sheer luck to obtain a plan of the present tent encampments on Lafarn's Plain and Farnborough Common, including the new barracks in the north and south camps. That is the only thing we need to complete our preparations. The attempt should be made within a fortnight, because the number of troops now drilling there is larger than any future concentration is likely to be. The time to strike is now, as soon as we possibly can. The weather predictions are for a week or more of fog and rain, ideal conditions for the attempt." "You had already located the line of that 4-foot main?" 6 months ago, Our spies near Aldershot had talked with some of the older villagers west of the camp who remembered when the pipe was laid down, but couldn't point out the exact line. It was that report which started the discussion in Berlin. We leased 3 old manor houses in different localities. 2 are near Hartford Bridge, and the other is on the border of the woods northeast of Bramshill Park House. There are 35 acres belonging to this manor, almost entirely wooded. We made borings in several places and had the luck to strike the main less than 300 feet from the house. It was a simple matter to excavate a tunnel from the cellar to it, but it took us a month before we could locate the lines as far as the woods of blackbushes and tap it for ventilation without being caught. Of course, the air in it would have killed anyone attempting to crawl through before that. By the end of the second month, we had rigged a little track for a miniature car and cleaned out the entire length to the first section, north of Fleet Pond at Aldershot. Then we commenced tunnelling in 2 directions, one toward the north camp and the other toward the south camp, with provision for piping under the present tent encampments on Lafarn's Plain, Farnborough Common and Long Valley. That work has been completed. Our tunnels are 20 feet underground. We don't dare go upward toward the surface until we know exactly where we can shove up the ends of 2-inch pipes without detection.
You have your materials all assembled for the work when the time comes.
Oh, yes, madam. We excavated a large chamber underground and brought in the machinery piece by piece. We run the place as a stock farm breeding horses. The stables are 1,500 feet from the manor house, so that army officers who come to purchase mounts very rarely stop there. With nearly 200 horses, mares and foals, we use a great deal of hay and straw. All of our lime and acid, the glazed tiling for the storage tank and the conduit through the big water main, has been fetched to us inside great loads of hay and straw for the stables. It has been slow work, getting the amount we needed for the attempt, but it is amazing how much can be accumulated in 6 months. For the past fortnight we have been running 8 air compressors by small paraffin motors and storing the liquid chlorine in an airtight, porcelain-lined reservoir adjoining that underground chamber. The manor house stands upon high ground, and the big water main was laid 25 feet below the surface at that point, so the liquid chlorine will run down into and along it by gravity. The end section of the main at Aldershot is 100 feet lower than that at Bramshill Park, and we have laid a porcelain-lined conduit through it for the entire distance, to carry the stuff. From the end of that conduit we will connect 2-inch cast-iron pipes and shove them from a few inches above the ground in spots among the tents and barracks where they will not be noticed, admitting the chlorine to them through a heavy gate valve at the proper moment.
You speak as though you had seen all these preparations yourself, Bettina.
I have, madame. It was necessary for me to know exactly what papers and drawings we required. Of course, if we cannot obtain the plan of the tent encampments, we must take our chances in coming up to the surface at spots determined by an underground survey. But that greatly increases the risk.
Suppose I succeed in obtaining that plan for you. I wonder if it would be safe for me to fetch it down to that manor house. Do you raise thoroughbreds at that stock farm? I ride in the park every morning. That would be a perfectly reasonable excuse for motoring down there.
Oh, yes, madame. And Franz Schufeldt would feel much honored if you would inspect his work. One never knows whether he will succeed or fail in an attempt like this, but it helps his standing in Wilhelmstrasse if it is known that he performed his part of the work faithfully. It would please us much, madame, if you would inspect the work and report it in Berlin.
The only point to be considered is whether by any chance my visit to that manor house might be remembered afterward and arouse suspicion. We couldn't afford that, because my work is even more important than yours.
We have sold horses to several of the aristocracy, madame, besides the army. You would be safe enough at the stables, and Franz could offer you tea at the manor house.
3 days later, the Condessa motored down to Hampshire and had little difficulty in locating the Bramshill stock farm owned by Mr. Frank Sheffield, a genial fox-hunting county squire whom nobody would have thought of being other than a roast-beef Englishman. After purchasing a beautiful chestnut mare for saddle use, she accepted his courteous suggestion of tea and gave him a lift in her car to the manor house. When secure from observation in his study, she handed him a flat parcel which she had been carrying in her muff. When he unfolded this upon his desk, it proved to be a tracing of the plan, less than 10 months old, upon which the tent encampments and new permanent barracks had been laid out. In fact, a detailed survey of everything in the Aldershot district, with smaller sheets of each camp. After going over it for half an hour, he led her down into the cellar by a concealed stairway and through a tunnel into the large underground chamber where the air compressors, vats, and great storage reservoir were. From one corner of this, he took her through a descending tunnel which ended in the old 4-foot water main. Here he showed her the porcelain-lined conduit which had been laid along the bottom of the piping, providing an inner sluiceway for the liquid chlorine, 16 inches wide and 6 high. At either side of this had been laid small rails upon which ran a miniature flat car about large enough to carry an average-sized man, lying at full length. At one end of it was an electric motor fed from a storage battery, and through the line of piping there was a strong current of fresh air from an electrically driven fan. Madame was strongly tempted to explore the entire 7 miles of piping and inspect the system of tunneling under Aldershot, but it would have taken at least 3 hours, and her long stay at the manor house might have been remembered. After she had left him, Mr. Sheffield, or Franz Schufelt, as he was known in Berlin, motored over to Aldershot with the details of the tracings fixed in his mind, and satisfied himself that they were correct in every particular. Next evening proved rainy and foggy. At 10 o'clock, a company of sappers left the South Camp in 2 motor vans and disappeared, around Fleet Pond, on the road which led through Blackbushes. In the heart of the woods they came upon a cavalry patrol sitting his horse where a little blind path left the road, which was a rough one, seldom used. Following him along this path they came to a big oak, in the bark of which they could just make out the lines of what had once been engineering symbols, cut many years before. Here, after lighting a dozen lanterns, they began digging a hole 10 feet in diameter, using great care to work as noiselessly as possible. At a depth of 4 feet they came upon a big cylindrical something which they carefully avoided striking with their spades. After 2 hours' work they had dug down at each side of the great cylinder until they could stow a number of packages under it. Twice while digging they had heard a rumbling sound inside which seemed to approach from the westward and then recede again. Each time this occurred they stood without making a sound until the noise had died away entirely. When their preparations were complete, several ends from a main wire were attached to the packages under the big cylinder, and they walked back to the road, paying out the wire after them. Then one of the engineers turned a crank in a square box, and there was a stunning concussion which shook the ground for a radius of 0.5 mile. Groping their way back to where they had been digging, they found a yawning pit 20 feet deep and 100 feet in diameter. The mangled trunks of a dozen trees had fallen into it, and upon opposite sides were torn and twisted sections of 4-foot iron piping, choked solid with debris. Leaving guards at the edge of the pit, the sappers climbed into their motor vans and returned to Aldershot. In the meanwhile, 3 troops of cavalry had ridden by another road to Bramshill Park, silently drawing a cordon about the stock farm and manor house, concealing themselves behind trees and shrubbery. There they waited until some men from the house came along in a car. These were quietly arrested and sent to Aldershot. In the next 2 hours, several other men and 1 woman came from the house and stables, being arrested like their fellows. At 10 in the morning the troopers closed in, but the house appeared to be deserted and the underground chambers also. Dynamite was then placed in various places, and the entire plant blown out of existence, after the troopers had ridden to a sufficient distance to be safe from the liberated chlorine in the big reservoir. Late that evening, Madame la Condesa, beautifully gowned for the opera, was awaiting the arrival of her escort, a cabinet minister, when there was a faint tapping at the door of her suite, and Ayesha admitted the girl Betty. When they were alone with the doors locked, Betty staggered to a chair, her teeth chattering. Pouring a glass of wine, the Condessa held it to her lips until she had swallowed it, and then said guardedly,
"Wait a few moments until your nerves are steadier, my dear. You increase the danger for all of us by going to pieces in this way.
I know that, madame. Oh, I know it. But every second I seem to feel the hand upon my shoulder. I fear some man I never saw before will take me by the elbow and whisper in my ear that I must go with him, quietly, without any show of resistance, as they did to poor Johann in the hotel office half an hour ago. It was done just as quietly as that. Johann knew, but he spoke to the manager and asked if he could go out for an hour or two with the gentleman upon a matter of importance. Then he put on his hat and coat and walked out with the man, smoking a cigarette. It was the same with Katrina on the second floor. A gentleman spoke to her in the corridor, told her to get into the servants' lift and go up to her room for her wraps. He didn't let her out of his sight for a second, made her walk out of the servants' entrance ahead of him. She knew there was no escape, so she didn't try to run away in the street. Mr. Chudley Sammis had been spending half an hour with Colonel Parker in his suite on this floor. He saw me in the corridor when he came out, whispered that he was leaving by the night train for Liverpool and sailing by one of the Lampert and Holt steamers for Buenos Aires, said he would tell the reporters that he was going down to study labour conditions in Argentina. The worst move he could possibly make, dangerous for all of us. Looks suspicious. They'll never let him sail. We must try to catch him on the telephone. What is it all about, anyhow?
Haven't you seen the evening papers, madame? It is said that someone at Aldershot heard a faint noise underground which made him suspect our tunnelling. Some of the engineer officers looked up the old reconstruction drawings, traced that line of water main, suspected our stock farm, and began watching it. Last night the sappers dynamited a section of the piping in the woods 2 miles west of Aldershot. This morning a cavalry detail arrested 9 of us from the manor house, found your tracings and other papers in Franz's desk, and blew up the whole plant. It is thought that 6 men, including Franz himself, are buried alive in the tunnels under the camps. The others were all shot at sunset. Johann and Katrina will be shot in the morning, or hanged, in the tower where they were taken.
Do you think that any of them betrayed you or the rest of us in London?
No, madam. They died without any admission of their Wilhelmstrasse connection, I am sure. But if Sir Thomas by any chance remembers what he told me in the library of his townhouse, the night he was drunk there alone with me, or if the disappearance of those plans is traced to you, madame, well, that would settle it.
Bettina, in the game we play, nothing is more certain to arouse suspicion than the slightest evidence of apprehension. I have faced death more than once with a laugh of amazed denial upon my lips, when I could see no possible escape and believed my life was measured only by seconds. Never admit being guilty even while you are dying. That is a principle in all underground diplomacy. Do not compromise others even if you must yourself die. The safest place in the world for Chudley Sammis is on the floor of the House of Commons, representing his constituency. The safest place for you and me just now is right here in this hotel, doing exactly what we've been doing every day. I doubt if the management knows anything whatsoever against you. Your duties here constitute an almost perfect alibi.
Considerably reassured, Betty left the Condessa's suite and tried to forget her haunting terror in the activities demanded by her position. But for a fortnight, several of the guests who really liked the girl thought from her paleness and lassitude that she must be coming down with a serious illness. In the room she occupied with 3 other girls, up under the roof, the dread of a Zeppelin raid and annihilation from the dynamite in the sandbags over her head was enough to prevent her sleeping for more than a few moments at a time. Upon the streets, the passing glance of an unknown man sent a chill down her back which made her feel faint. One night, at the house in Soho, she typed a warning to the hotel management concerning the dynamite. When no attention was paid to it, she sent another anonymous warning, and was immensely relieved when finally the explosive was removed. The constant strain she had been under for 10 months in London had developed a functional weakness in her heart which nothing but rest and freedom from anxiety could relieve. Had she known that she was under constant espionage from Downing Street men, she would probably have died of heart failure. But with the idea of using the girl to obtain future information vital to the safety of England, Lady Nan insisted that she be left unmolested unless caught in some fresh plot against the Empire. As for Madame herself, Betty felt a wonderful admiration for her sang-froid and apparent indifference to deadly risk.